Page, there's some objections to apologetics. I remember one guy coming to our church when I was a kid, or at least maybe my young teens, and he said, this week somebody sent me a creation magazine and I threw it straight in the bin because my faith is not placed in any evidences that the creation magazine could give me. My faith is placed in the Word of God and the Word of God alone. You know, the creation magazine is a magazine which gives evidence that presents evidence that God has created. So some people have that point of view that apologetics is not necessary. Some of those objections reflect that. On the second page, there's different types of apologetic approaches. Three different types there. The fideist, I don't know how to pronounce that, but that's how I'll pronounce it anyway. I guess that's kind of what that man was who came to our church. Basically what he was saying was the Word of God is self-authenticating. In other words, you read the Bible and that's all you need. It will reveal itself as the Word of God. That's all you need. And God is self-authenticating. And I would say, yes, the Bible can be self-authenticated. God can reveal himself in that way, but that doesn't mean that you've got to throw out the evidences that we find in the world as well. Anyway, so I'll leave you to read that if you're interested. I'm going to come to the third page and think about how to do apologetics. And this was just sort of a list I sort of just kept on adding to as I was doing these notes, and you could probably add another half a dozen as well, I'm sure. Maybe as before we get started, I thought we might do this little activity. I don't know if you've heard of the movie The Bucket. Anybody heard of the movie called The Bucket? Yeah. The Bucket List, sorry. The Bucket List, yeah, that's what I meant. The Bucket List is about these two guys. They're told they've got 6 months to live. And so they come up with this list of things that they want to do before they kick the bucket in 6 months. And interesting movie with reflections about life and the meaning of life. And this is one scene, they're on an aeroplane. Carter is a Christian, or at least a religious guy, whereas Edward is a total materialist, hedonist, just living for himself and for a good time, and they're having this discussion. So Carter looks out the window of the aeroplane and says, look at all the stars, this really is one of God's good ones. Edward, so you think a being of some sort did all this? You don't. You mean, do I believe if I look up in the sky and promise this or that, the biggie will make all this go away? No. And by that he means probably that God will make all my cancer go away? No. And Carter says, so 95% of the people on earth are wrong. Edward says, if life has taught me anything, it's that 95% of the people are always wrong. It's called faith. I envy people who have faith, I just can't get my head around it. Maybe your head is in the way. Discuss. What do you think of that conversation? What can we learn from it? Critique it? How could Carter have maybe held that conversation better? What do you notice about it? So, discuss in groups of two or three. So, just to help you along, maybe two things: what did Carter do well, and what didn't he do well? And secondly, maybe what is the movie by having this script, having this conversation? What is the movie subtly saying about Christian faith and how it presents Carter? Okay. Okay, that'll do. What observations did you make? Yeah, good opening. Everyone agree? It was a good opening, a good engaging of Carter. I thought it of Edward. I thought it was. Yeah, I agree. A good, just natural. Brings God into his conversation naturally and looks at creation, brings God in as part of everyday conversation. I thought that was good. Yeah, why? What's he doing there? Yeah, it certainly isn't. Anyone else? What do you make of that? You don't. Yeah. Okay, let's just finish off this you don't business. yeah, I mean, you can read it either way, and I mean, on the spur of the moment, in real life, I mean, you know, maybe it's a question to keep things going. But I think what it is doing is Carter is presuming that everyone should believe. Everyone does believe. This is sort of 95% of people believe. This is what everyone does. And it's just sort of presuming that, of course, Edward, you should believe, because that's just what everyone does. And I think if you're coming from an atheist point of view, that's sort of saying, well, you forcing my cultural heritage of Christendom, you know, the last 1900 years we've been living in Christendom, in which the church is at the center of society and everybody is a Christian and everybody respects God. And so Carter is saying, you have to belong to that, surely. Everybody belongs to that system of thought. And Edward says, of course I don't. We're past that. I've rejected that whole way of thinking. We're in a new, brave world where everybody thinks for themselves. So don't put me in that pigeonhole. I don't think it's helpful to just presume that everybody in our society is a Christian anymore. I think we've got to acknowledge that, yes, we're in a new era in which the church is not respected and people are not just by default sort of believers in God. Okay, now Shannon, you were saying about... Yeah. Any more comments on that, Faith? He said that he doesn't use any scriptures to back it up. He doesn't explain what faith is. And it's, I think the movie is sort of trying to say that faith is just this sort of mystical sort of feeling which floats into some people's head, and some people aren't lucky and it sort of floats by them. Some people have it, some people don't. He just says, oh, this thing, it's just called faith. And, and Edward says, oh, I wish I could have faith, I just don't have it. And, maybe your head is in the way. So what's that saying? It's saying that reason is and faith are two opposite ideas, isn't it? And that's what Richard Dawkins does constantly. He just repeats like this sort of mantra. Atheists use reason. Christians use faith. And faith is sort of the opposite of reason. Faith is stupidity. Believing things which you almost... you know it isn't true, sort of thing. Okay, anything else on that? I just thought it was an interesting scene, interesting dialogue. Well, if not, let's quickly go through. These are just some principles for apologetics, doing apologetics. As I say, you might be able to add to it. I had to write down one more during our morning tea break, just from discussion with somebody, so you might be able to add some more. Number one, apologetics is not just an intellectual game, it's a form of spiritual warfare, so pray. It has dangers in that we can treat it like a game in which we love winning arguments, and this is an opportunity to show how smart we are and to shoot someone down, to nail them. It can appeal to our pride. I don't know if there's some people in this world who love to sit around and throw ideas around. Some people are like that. My family was like that. Just sit around the dinner table and just throw ideas around. And if you got into a discussion or an argument, then that was enjoyable and you enjoyed the intellectual exchange. Some people, they just... not into that, just agree on everything and make peace. Well, for people like my family, you can treat apologetics like a bit of a game. It's a bit of a show how smarter you are than the other person and try to always come out on top. So there's a danger in that, that we treat it like a game. but it is a form of spiritual warfare. And when we do things like, if you take the time to read Richard Dawkins' book, you can find yourself under spiritual attack. And when you go out into the marketplace and all of a sudden you meet a Muslim who is firmly convinced that the Quran is the real revealed word of God, and he's possibly been trained a lot harder than you've been trained, and he's pumping all these arguments at you, you're under attack spiritually. And you need to pray. You need to really rely on the Spirit of God and treat it as a spiritual exercise. Oh. So, pray. I'll add another one. Just repeat. I guess we've already said this before, but I was just again reminded of this in our discussion at morning tea, and I thought I'd add it to the list. Apologetics doesn't save souls. Apologetics doesn't save souls. You can sort of, a person can be hammering you with questions and you can answer every single one, but that doesn't mean they're going to become a Christian. And, you can answer everybody's questions and they just still won't bow their will. And you think, what's wrong here? I'm answering every step of the way. But it's the Spirit of God who saves. And he can use a variety of methods. And he'll often use other methods, such as, the testimony of your life and something happening in your experience. So don't be surprised when you've answered every question and yet still there's nothing happening. God will often use different methods. So apologetics doesn't save souls. It's the Spirit of God who saves souls. The Spirit of God may use apologetics, but he may just as well use a whole number of other methods. Number two, do your homework. Be prepared. Know where to get info. Okay, don't need to say anything more on that. We've already said that. Be prepared to confess your ignorance. So if you don't know the answer to a question, as I said before, one of the reasons why we don't like evangelism is because we're afraid. And one of the reasons why we're afraid is we're afraid that they might ask us a tricky question which we don't know the answer to. Well, we shouldn't be afraid of that. We should just say, I don't know. That's a great question. Never thought of that before. Or I haven't really looked into that. And what you're doing, in doing that, you're showing them your genuineness of your character, and you're showing them that it's not about a pride thing, it's not a thing about winning arguments, and you're showing them Christian humility. So confess your ignorance, but then of course follow it up and share what you find. Number three, listen to their beliefs carefully and ask them questions. So even if you're engaged in a discussion with someone and you don't really know what to say to them, well, you can just ask questions and find out what they believe. Not to try to corner them into some argument. Don't ask questions. Well, I think we all do this in a matter of conversation, but I think we need to beware of trying to corner people with tricky questions and sort of try to drive them into a corner. So you say, so do you believe this? Then you must believe that. Then you must believe that. Therefore, we try to corner them. And invariably, it's like trying to corner a mouse. And the mouse just skips over, and the mouse can always skip out. So beware of trying to ask all these tricky questions, and what you're trying to do by asking your questions is trying to corner them intellectually. When you ask questions because you really want to know what they believe, and listen to them. Mark Driscoll, I don't know if you've heard of Mark Driscoll, he's a really well-known preacher in America. But he does things like, he goes down to the pub and sits down and says, look, I'm a pastor doing some, preparing for a sermon. I'm preaching this week on hell. Just wondered if I can ask for your opinion about what do you think about hell? And he would ask questions about hell, what they thought about hell. And then he'd bring that into the pulpit, and great sermon preparation. He knows what people in the world are really thinking about hell. But he's asking questions and finding out what people really think. And he'd go into shopping centres in the middle of the day when there's not many crowds around, and he would ask them about you know, just say, I'm a pastor, I'm just doing, finding out what people think. And not there to preach, just to ask questions. And people respond to that, because all of a sudden they know that it's not this man just dumping all of this information on me. This guy is here to learn from me. So, it's not always about us getting our information onto them. Often it's about listening carefully to what they're saying first. Now, very obviously, be careful of winning arguments but losing friends. Speak in love. Express your opinion rather than try to shoot them down. So instead of maybe asking questions and trying to corner them with your questions, perhaps ask questions, find out what they really believe, and then say, okay, that's really interesting. Let me share with you my view on life. And you share, you've earned the right, having asked them questions about their view, and then you say, well, this is my view, and what you share with your view, you put your view on the table, it shows them perhaps the weaknesses in their view, and you're showing them an alternative, and then they're looking at your view and comparing it with their view. Becky Pippet, she's an American evangelist, she's mentioned this really, I thought it was a great line, that is, in this whole thing of being afraid of putting people off by coming on too strong with your arguments and your presentation of the truth. She says, before you even start, if you're worried about this, just say, look, can you let me know if I'm coming on too strong? I don't want to Bible bash you. I know that non-Christians are often sort of a bit intimidated by Christians coming along and thinking they've got all the answers. So just let me know. Just tap me on the shoulder and say, hey, back off, Becky. You know, you're just coming on too heavy. Just let me know. And people would be amazed by that. Wow, that's thoughtful of her. She knows that I'm get worried about these sorts of things. So, be careful of winning arguments but losing friends. Be careful of answering a question but killing a conversation. So, we've already talked about this. It's one thing to know the answer to a question, but then again, we've got to go to the next step and think carefully about how we can present it in a way which is going to stimulate their thinking and further conversation. So, someone said when they open the door a little bit, they might ask a little question. Just seeing if it's safe to talk about Christianity, and they open that door just a little bit. When they open the door a little bit, don't barge in with all your might and say, hallelujah, here's a chance to dump the gospel on this guy and answer all his questions in one go. No, don't barge in. When they open the door a little bit, just step in, answer the question, and then back out and see if they open the door a little bit wider and invite you in a little bit wider. So just take your time. Ask people for their point of view. So share your point of view, then say, what do you think about that? How do you look at life? Number six, learn and appeal to authorities. And this is part of number five, I guess, in that you can tell people's stories. So it's not just a matter of this is what I think, this is my knowledge, you're very privileged to hear today, which I'm going to share with you. Tell a story. Here's four people. Frank Morrison, of course, was a famous guy who tried to set out to prove the resurrection wrong. He liked Christianity, but he just didn't like the resurrection bit. And of course, he studied the evidence and he became a Christian because of it. And just say, he wrote a famous book, Who Moved the Stone, you know. And what you're doing is you're telling stories rather than just sharing information. And people like stories more than just being hit with information. William Ramsey, he was a guy who doubted the historicity of the New Testament. And again, he studied the evidence, became a Christian because of it. Anthony Flew, you heard of Anthony Flew? He was probably the world's most influential atheist of this century. Go into libraries, you can go into the philosophy section, and he's written half a dozen books on atheism. About three or four years ago, he publicly converted to theism. He's not a Christian, but he has said, I don't believe in atheism any longer. Now I believe that there must be a God. And you know, this is huge. This is like Billy Graham publicly declaring he's become an atheist. It's like that. This guy was the number one atheist. Anthony Flew. He did a debate with William Lane Craig. He did a debate with another guy, Gary Habermas, who's an expert on the resurrection we'll talk about later. You know, all 10 years ago he did it. Now he's a theist. And who knows, we'll talk about it later, but he looks at the evidence for the resurrection and he says, wow, this is pretty interesting stuff at the end of his book. He's just put out a book called There Is a God. At the end of it, he spends a chapter talking about the evidence for the resurrection of Jesus. And at the end of it, he says, this is fascinating stuff. You know, he's really thinking. So pray for Anthony Flew. Wouldn't it be wonderful if he became a Christian? C.S. Lewis, he was a great atheist who became a famous Christian and had a huge influence after his conversion. And he made the two-step change. First of all, he became a theist and then he became a Christian. So we need to pray for Anthony Flew as well. And Pincus Lapide, he's a guy who's not a Christian, he's a Jew, but he looked at the evidence for the resurrection, a Jewish historian. After looking at the evidence, he said, wow, Jesus must have risen from the dead. Don't know what to do with that. I'll just change my Judaism to allow a Judaism where you can have someone rise from the dead and not be the Messiah, but I have to admit, it does look like he did rise from the dead. There's a few people like that. Okay, so these are stories which catch people's mind, and it's not just dumping information on them, it's telling them, hey, there was a guy who, Anthony Flew, did you hear about Anthony Flew? It's capturing their interest with a story. People don't want to hear lectures. And once you've shared that story, then they might be more open to hearing that more factual stuff that you've got to share as well. Tell stories and appeal to contemporary culture. Living in the postmodern world, people love stories and they love movies and they love literature, where all these ideas get tossed around. Like in the bucket list. The bucket list is a story about two guys playing around with what is the meaning of life. And it creates great openings for the gospel to say, if you've seen the bucket list and they've seen it, and you say, hey, what do you think of, Carter, that was really interesting, wasn't it? That conversation they had there in that plane, or they have another conversation at the top of a pyramid about what the ancient Egyptians believed was necessary to enter into eternal life. That's fascinating how you've got this atheist and this other guy. And it's talking about apologetics on their turf, which is popular culture. You're talking about it on their turf. Apologetics and religion comes up constantly in The Simpsons. Every second episode you've got a religious theme in The Simpsons. Simpsons is one of the great programs which our Western generation, that's where they're getting their religious education from. Outside RE in schools, which we can thank God for, but people are being brought up to think about Christianity on The Simpsons. And so to bring up scenes from The Simpsons and say, you're thinking Christianity is a bit like that, don't you? Makes a great springboard. Okay. Now, one which I'll talk about a few times is what we might call use the minimal facts, or we might call it the even if approach, to reduce quibbling and to move discussions onto their territory. We're going to talk about a guy called Gary Habermas, who's an expert on the resurrection of Jesus, and he calls this approach the minimal facts approach. And what Gary Habermas does is he says, okay, obviously not all atheists agree with everything that I believe, so I'm just going to use the arguments that atheists actually I'm just going to use the facts which atheists actually agree with me on. And he goes and looks at the evidence on the resurrection, and he just uses the facts which atheists actually believe. And he says, well, what do you make of those facts? So they're basically saying, even if what you believe is true, Christianity still follows. So two examples of this. The Big Bang Theory. Okay, I'm going to talk about this in the next session. But the Big Bang Theory. Christians, we often sort of think of this as this is the devil's doctrine. But the even if approach says, so what? Even if the Big Bang Theory was true, do you know what that shows? That shows that there must be a God. The Big Bang Theory. Bible contradictions. Gary Habermas, he just says, okay, you say there's contradictions in the Bible. You know, let's say even if there are contradictions in the Bible, does that prove Christianity wrong? No, you've still got to deal with Jesus' resurrection, which is where he points it. Okay, we'll come to this a bit more and give it more detail. But what this does is it avoids going to all these arguments. And so another way you could use this is with the theory of evolution. And so instead of getting into this huge, massive debate about whether evolution did occur and whether there's missing links or whether they've been found or whether they haven't been found, and going into all this huge debate, it's possible to say, you know, even if evolution did occur, and by the way, I personally believe that it didn't occur. I think there's evidence that it didn't occur. But let's say it did occur. Does that prove that Christianity is false? No, it doesn't. Okay, that's what this principle suggests. So, and avoids getting into all those detailed arguments which go round and round in circles. Number 9, start with simple statements to initiate and delve deeper as conversation progresses. So you've got some really, you know, what you think is a really decent argument for the existence of God. Well, just don't dump it on them. And we'll be looking at some of these arguments in the next session. But you just can't give it to them all in the one go, and and all your arguments and counter arguments and rebuttals all in the one go. You've just got to tease it out, put in a little bit, wait for their response. Then as they respond back, come back a little bit with a little bit more. And as they express more interest, then you come back again with more. So just be patient. There's a couple of bridging points, which are common bridging points to start these sort of apologetic conversations. Unsatisfied longing. People are unsatisfied with life. How often do you come across that? People unsatisfied with life. And that's an opportunity to bring in the start of an apologetic conversation and say, you know, I think this unsatisfaction that we all seem to be plagued with everywhere, we all seem to have this unsatisfaction. You know what I think that is? I think that's an expression of our need for something more, an expression for a spiritual fulfillment. Do you feel that? So that's a bridging point. Design and beauty of creation. Well, that's what Carter was doing, wasn't it? He looked out the window and said, wow, that's one of God's... God did a good job with that one. He's pointing to the beauty of creation and using that to direct conversation to Christ. And morality. The whole issue of morality, we'll talk about that a bit too later, but talking about, is there an objective... are there objective moral standards? And if so, where do they come from? They must come from God. Number 10, don't get sidetracked into side issues. We've talked about that. Graciously insist on dealing with one topic at a time. So if someone brings up a red herring, you're talking about the resurrection, and all of a sudden they want to start talking about evolution, you say, evolution, yeah, that's a really interesting subject, but hey, what do you think? Can we just finish on this resurrection bit before we move on to evolution? If you really want to talk about evolution, yeah, that's fine, but can we just stick with this topic first and deal with that one topic at a time? 11, challenge people to read the Bible for themselves. Sometimes the proof of the pudding is in the eating. And time again, people have found this, haven't they? Just push people towards the Bible. Let the Bible loose. I think it's Spurgeon who said, what did he say about the lion? You don't need to defend a lion, it'll defend itself. Let the Bible loose. And I guess, you know, we can always say, talking about the Bible, have you read it recently? Have you actually read the primary documents, first century biographies of Jesus? Have you actually read that for yourself? You should give it a read and so you know what you're talking about before you start mouthing off about it. Get people to read the scriptures themselves, and many will find it self-authenticating. They'll find that the Spirit of God has inspired it. And finally, number 12, practice and seek to improve. So, you won't get it all right in one go. You'll need to practice and practice and practice, so don't be discouraged. Okay, well, that's all I've shared for how. Have you got any more how-to points to add that you've learnt from your experience that are important? Phil? Yeah. 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 It's kind of like the Mormon approach when they bring around three of their friends. Yeah. Okay. Good. How are we going for time? Do you want to keep on going, or are you hot? Hot and tired. Done half an hour, have we? Okay, well, maybe we'll just get started on the second one. Presenting the evidence for God. Okay, I'll just have to change files here. Okay, what I'm going to do in session two, I'm going to present the arguments for the existence of God. Now, this is pretty relevant. Richard Dawkins, who, he's just an atheist. He's just going straight for God. Does God exist? That's his main thing. God doesn't exist. So I think that's fairly important to deal with this issue. Does God exist? And then the other main positive argument for Christianity, presenting the evidence for Jesus, is what we're going to do tomorrow sometime. I'm going to present five arguments. There's more than five. There's lots of arguments which different people have come up with over the years. These arguments are copied straight from William Lane Craig. And he uses them again and again and again. He uses the same speech in every debate he does. He just says, these are my five arguments, refute them if you can. They're very successful. Some of them are better than others, and what you need to be thinking about is, which one would I use? Which would be easiest to use? How would I use it? I mean, I've put together about 10 pages here of notes. I can't dump 10 pages of information on people in a conversation. How would I actually use this? Or where would I start? Some of them are more defensive arguments, whereas some are more positive. This first one, it's a positive argument. It's called the cosmological argument, is the technical name for it. But you might want to remember it by the causal argument. It's about the argument from cause. Okay, so it's got three premises. Everything that begins to exist has a cause. The universe began to exist, therefore the universe had a cause, God. Now, that's the logic of it. I don't think it's really a helpful way to present it in a conversation. Just to say, okay, I've got three unbeatable logical statements which I'm going to hit you with. You ready? I'm going to prove it to you. So I've presented down towards the end of that section somewhere or other, introducing or communicating the cosmological argument. And I suggest maybe something like this might be a good way to start. Where do you think the universe came from? This is down at the beginning of... Where is it? Page 5. Halfway down page 5. Where do you think the universe came from? Hasn't been around forever, has it? Do you think it just popped out of nothing? Don't you think that there must have been an eternal cause? So those are questions which just raise the topic, and then from there, then that would, if that conversation got going, then that would give you the opportunity to spell out this sort of logical thinking. But okay, let's go through this statement by statement. First statement of the argument is everything that begins to exist has a cause. It's fairly logical, isn't it? Everything that begins to exist has a cause. Things just don't pop into existence. William Lane Craig says, you know, we don't expect all of a sudden a horse just to pop into existence on this veranda. That's ridiculous. Horses don't pop into existence. Things just don't happen. If you hear a gunshot, what do we say? What caused that? Who shot a gun? You don't just say, gunshot just happened. No reason, just happened. Yeah? Things which happen have a cause. So, isn't that true for our universe? Mustn't there be a reason? Mustn't there be a cause for it? Something that caused it to happen? Which is where it's going. Number two, so everything that begins to exist has a cause. Number two, the universe began to exist. Now, this is the one which people might question. Well, has the universe begun to exist? And so this is where you've got to argue your case for this argument. Has the universe begun to exist? Some people say, no, it was eternal. It's just always been here. So we don't need a God who started the universe. So there's a number of arguments there saying that, yes, the universe must have begun to exist. There's a philosophical argument to start with. If the world was eternal in the past, then the present moment would never arrive. Would it? Now wouldn't have arrived because it would have already arrived because the world would have never begun. It's just ridiculous, the idea of an infinity of events in time. It just doesn't really make sense. But then, science has demonstrated that the universe began to exist, William Lane Craig says. The second law of thermodynamics, if you're into your science, says that the universe will eventually suffer a heat death and self-destruct. Energy always runs down. Things don't rise in their energy levels. Things decrease. Water cools. It doesn't naturally warm up unless energy is being added to it. Energy goes down, and that's true of the whole universe. Scientists believe that the universe will eventually suffer a heat death and self-destruct. So if it's existed eternally in the past, it would have already done this. So it can't have. It can't have existed always. It must have begun. And then, here comes the Big Bang Theory. And William Lane Craig says that the Big Bang Theory proves that the universe had a beginning. Because whether you like the Big Bang Theory or not, what does the Big Bang Theory basically say? The Big Bang Theory basically says that the universe was not eternal in the past, but it came into being a finite time ago. It was an absolute origin out of nothing. It brought all space, time, and energy into existence. That's what scientists believe about the Big Bang Theory. It brought everything into existence. Before that, there was no time, there was no matter, there was no energy, nothing. Nothing existed. And then after the Big Bang, things happened. So, now, William Lane Craig is a Christian who believes in the Big Bang. I'd say that would be fairly controversial for many of us here, whether you believe in the Big Bang Theory as promoted in secular science. But that's not the point. Young Earth creationists, they've got a slightly different theory, which sometimes they call a white hole cosmology, but it's the same idea at the end of the day, just different timing and different in its details. But the idea is that the universe began a finite time ago and has expanded. And if you've got a universe that began out of nothing and expanded, then you've got this point. And so, the Big Bang Theory, ironically, for many of us, I guess, proves it points to a beginning of the universe, which points to there must be a cause of the universe. What's interesting is that when the Big Bang Theory was first postulated by Einstein and others at the beginning of the 20th century, the scientists couldn't believe it. They hated it. They did not like it. Here's a guy who wrote at the time, Sir Arthur Eddington, "The expansion of the universe was so preposterous and incredible that I feel almost an indignation that anyone should believe in it except myself. The beginning seems to present insuperable difficulties unless we agree to look on it as frankly supernatural." Albert Einstein held off for the Big Bang Theory for years because he knew what it implied. It implied that there must be a God who started, who brought the whole universe into being. And the history of the 20th century has actually been, if you look at the theories of the scientists in cosmology, what they have been trying to do is to get rid of this beginning of the universe. And so I think I've put in your notes there, you've got all these different theories which have happened, and what all these theories have been trying to do is get rid of a beginning because they want an eternal universe. In the 1940s, it was called the steady state model, in which the universe was constantly creating new matter. They realized that wasn't going to work. 1960s and 70s, the oscillating universe. The universe is constantly expanding, but then it's coming back down and eternally expanding and contracting, eternally expanding, contracting. Didn't work. 1980s and 1990s, I don't know how to explain these, so I won't bother. Maybe Bill's a physics teacher, maybe he'd have more knowledge of this than me. But vacuum fluctuation models, chaotic inflationary model, what they're trying to do is get rid of the beginning. They want an eternal universe, but it just doesn't work. And now, 2003, before we go there, William Lane Craig says, commenting on the 20th century, "The standard model's prediction, that's the normal Big Bang model of you've got a beginning expanding through the an expansion of the universe. The standard model's prediction of an absolute beginning has persisted through a century of astonishing progress in theoretical and observational cosmology and survived an onslaught of alternative theories, with each successive failure of alternative cosmogenic theories to avoid the absolute beginning of the universe predicted by the standard model, i.e. the Big Bang Theory, that prediction has been corroborated." They might, to get rid of a beginning of the universe, which the Big Bang Theory suggests, they just haven't been able to do it. And then in 2003, three atheist cosmologists, Bordak, Guth and Vilenkin, they write that it's impossible, and they concede defeat. It is impossible to avoid an absolute beginning of the universe. And they say it doesn't matter how you fiddle it, no matter what theory you've come up with, we've been trying for nearly 100 years, we must have a space-time boundary. Vilenkin says, "It's said that an argument is what convinces reasonable men, a proof is what it takes to convince even an unreasonable man. With a proof now in place, cosmologists can no longer hide behind the possibility of a past eternal universe. There is no escape. They have to face the problem of a cosmic beginning." These guys are atheists, and they say, we've got a beginning. They don't like it, because it means there must be something outside of the universe, who's outside of time, outside of matter, who started the whole thing. So, premise three, therefore, the universe had a cause. Everything that begins to exist has a cause. The universe began to exist. Therefore, the universe had a cause. God. But Richard Dawkins says, well, why do you call that cause God? Okay, there was something that caused the universe to begin. Why call it God? Richard Dawkins says, even if we allow the dubious luxury of arbitrarily conjuring up a terminator, in other words, a beginning of the universe, even if you allow a beginning of the universe and you give it a name, simply because we need one, there is absolutely no reason to endow that terminator with any of the properties normally ascribed to God. Omnipotence, goodness, creativity of design, to say nothing of such human attributes as listening to prayers, forgiving sins, reading innermost thoughts, it's more parsimonious to conjure up, say, a Big Bang singularity, or some other physical concept as yet unknown. Calling it God is at best unhelpful and at worst perniciously misleading. So he's complaining and saying, you're not allowed to call it God. There's a beginning of the universe, something that caused it. You're not allowed to call it God. There's another quote by another guy who says the same thing. So why call the first cause God? Well, you think about that, what must have caused the universe. It must be transcended over space and time, existing atemporally, because this cause is outside of time, non-spatially, because space only came into existence through this cause. Must be changeless and immaterial, because again, time only began through this cause. Beginningless and uncaused. Unimaginably powerful, as this being created the universe. And it must be personal, because there must have been a decision to get this cause to make it happen. From an eternity past, there must have been a decision at some point, and you need a person to make a decision. So, when you look at those five statements, sounds very much like what we call God, if you ask me, doesn't it? Personal, powerful, beginningless, eternal, and transcended over space and time. But of course, then there's one more objection. But what is the cause of God? And this is a question which we all need to know the answer, because youngest child will start asking this question. Mummy, who created God? Where did God come from? Richard Dawkins presents it in slightly different language, but really it's the same question. And he says this proves God wrong. This proves that God is so improbable that it's not worth worrying about. Richard Dawkins says, design is not a real alternative at all, because it raises an even bigger problem than it solves. Who designed the designer? But of course, what we have said is everything that begins to exist. Premise one, everything that begins to exist has a cause. God did not begin to exist. Therefore, by definition, he doesn't have a cause. It's a silly question. It's a meaningless question. It's a bit like asking who is the bachelor's wife. To ask who caused God, well, no one caused God. God, by definition, is eternal. So therefore, you can't ask who caused him. How did God start? Who is the bachelor's wife? Bachelors don't have wives. Silly question. How did God start? God doesn't start. Silly question. Okay, but by contrast, the universe, we have shown, did have a beginning, and therefore it needs a cause. What's that cause? That's the cosmological argument. Now, you've got to work out in your mind, would I use that one? I think it appeals to people in a sense, in that it's got some, you know, it's quite understandable, this whole issue of, well, what caused our world to start? Whether you really want to get into all the science and argue about whether the universe is eternal and get into all of that stuff, that's getting pretty complicated. But it's helpful to know that even if, say, the Big Bang Theory was right, that's on our side. That proves that there was a God. A beginning of the universe proves that there was a God. So it's helpful to be aware of that stuff. But I don't know. I personally like number two. But we'll have to wait for that tomorrow. I think number two is an easier entry point level, the design argument. Anyway, we'll leave it there. Any comments or questions? Okay.